You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 2 years into the pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci joins the show with a look at the latest COVID trends, advisories for safety, and what the future could hold. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, have you ever had a moment where you wished you could be different? Maybe a new social situation where you let your shyness get the best of you, or a time when you let someone walk all over you and you wish you'd spoken up? Our next guest says she's had her own versions of those kind of moments, and that got her interested in the science behind personality. She took a closer look at that in a recent piece for The Atlantic and set out on a 3-month experiment to see if she could change her own personality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What parts of your personality do you love? What parts would you change if you could? Have you ever tried consciously to change something about your personality? Introverts out there, have you tried to be extroverts? I can relate. Did it work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Olga Hazan is a staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the book Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
What got you interested in changing your own personality, Olga?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pandemic happened, and at first, you know, like many introverts, I was sort of like, yay, I don't have to go see people, you know, but then I kind of was thinking, you know, am I really that introverted? Like, I kind of do find myself missing human interaction and maybe wanting to expand my social circle a little bit. And I also, I mean, I've just always known that I've been very neurotic my whole life. And it definitely has a detrimental effect on my personality and my life. So I wanted to see if I could reduce my neuroticism as well.
And as always, Olga, when you did this, it wasn't just about you. You went and looked at a lot of the science here. And there have been disagreements, changing ideas in the psychological world over whether we can change our personalities at all. What did you find out?
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's like sort of this folk wisdom, you know, that, you know, people never change, you'll always be the same. And, you know, I don't want to overstate things. Like, it's likely that, you know, you will be recognizable, you know, from, you know, the time you're in your early 20s to the time you're in your 60s. But it is still likely that you'll change on at least one personality trait over that period of time. And actually, you know, scientists who have looked into this and who have studied personality change have found that people can actually kind of nudge their personalities into the direction that they would like it to go, basically by behaving in the way that they would like their new personality to be. So if you want to be really bubbly and outgoing, you have to go to a lot of parties and meet a lot of people and talk to people and say hello and try new things and like all those other scary things that introverts hate, you know, but eventually that can actually become part of your personality.
Let's talk about what constitutes personality. You went for your experiment with this kind of 5-category process. You've already touched on them a little bit. Can you sum up what the 5 are in kind of a Cliff's Notes version?
Yeah, definitely. So scientists think that your personality consists of 5 factors. So there's the acronym is OCEAN, if you want an easy way to remember them. So the first one is openness to experience, which is sort of how kind of down with new types of cuisines and movies and music you are. Then there's a conscientiousness, which is, you know, getting places on time and making plans and, you know, getting things done. There's extroversion, you know, which is pretty self-explanatory. Agreeableness, which is sort of how cuddly, you know, touchy-feely you are. And neuroticism, which is the one that I struggle with, which is sort of this proclivity toward anxiety and depression.
We're talking to Olga Hazan from The Atlantic about her 3-month experiment to change her personality and what she learned about the science of personality along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or maybe your own reflections on how your personality has changed over time, on accident or on purpose. Call 800-642-1234. Olga, you picked a few of those traits, tried to change them. What were some of the operational ways? How did you actually try to start changing these facets of your personality?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that I tried that I actually ended up really enjoying was I took an improv class. So if you're someone like me who's a total control freak, and is also very introverted and doesn't like to put themselves out there, improv is a great way to not allow you to do any of that like all at once. So it forces you to kind of get up and out in front of people, behave in these like really silly ways. And then often in improv things go wrong, like thus the improvisational nature of it. You know, your scene partner doesn't say what you expect them to say, or just something unexpected happens. So it kind of requires you to roll with the punches a little bit. So that's one that I actually really enjoyed. I also took an anger management class, and I tried meditating as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I love this topic.
Yeah, what's your experience, Brian?
So I actively tried to and succeeded in not just breaking out of my shell, but feeling like I completely smashed it. When I was in high school, I was part of a foreign student ambassadorship program known as People to People, and I went to Australia with 40 other people from a whole bunch of different schools. And as a result, I came back and I went to college and actively was not my introverted self. I was a t-shirt with witty quips guy with baggy jeans. And when I went to college, I was polos and smiles and khakis and nice shoes. And as a result, I had a great first semester in college. I was very amicable. I was genial. I became more empathetic to other people who were also introverted. But ultimately, I kind of stepped back. I just felt like I gained skills that allowed me to kind of be more flexible in more situations than I was before when I was 100% that angsty teenager in high school.
Wow. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that. And Olga, he kind of is spoiling some of your conclusions. I think you found similar things with your extroversion experiences when he talked about skills there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I love what this caller said because, yeah, so it's not, so he kind of learned how to be an extrovert, which is totally in line with what a lot of experts say, which is that you can kind of learn these skills, and learn these abilities so that when the time or the situation calls for being an extrovert, you can do it. You don't have to be kind of afraid of the networking reception or what have you, that because you understand that that is within you. And even if you occasionally need to retreat and be kind of in a in a quiet room by yourself, so that you can go back to being an introvert for a little bit, you at least have those skills so you know how to do it if the situation calls for it.
Brian, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Olga, let's step into that anger management class now. This is something that where people go in the hopes of changing their personality, or somebody hopes they're going to change that personality. You mentioned a lot of your classmates, unlike you, were there by a court order. Did you take skills out of that helped you? You're not like I think a smash stuff in public kind of person, but did you get skills there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most important things that I understood from anger management was just that anger is about expectations. So, like a lot of things that make us angry are actually because our expectations were foiled in some way. So, there was like a really interesting moment early on in the class where they talked about whether traffic makes us angry. And it was kind of funny because I think the instructors expected us all to say like, yeah, I hate traffic, but no one said that because we all live in this very congested area of the country where there's always a lot of traffic. And we were all sort of like, yeah, I expect there to be traffic and it doesn't really bother me when it happens. So that's kind of when we realized that a lot of things in life are kind of like that traffic that you can kind of learn to expect, and maybe it doesn't bother you so much.
Okay, now how did you operationalize that in your life, Olga, for that moment where you did find yourself getting angry because the world didn't match your expectations, which is going to happen to all of us sometimes?
Yeah, so another strategy for, yeah, so definitely like you can't always have your expectations match reality. So one thing they learned that's been kind of helpful for me is actually this sounds a little strange, but it's plunging your hands or your face into ice water. which I don't know exactly why it works, but apparently it kind of like conveys signals through the vagus nerve, which tells you to kind of calm down, or it kind of like shocks your system a little bit. So if you are in a place where you have ice water handy, I have done this before. I will just stick my face in ice water. Another option, if you, I don't know if you, your lakes are still frozen or whatever, you can go, you know, just kind of go put your face in some really cold water.
They're pretty cold.
And that kind of, you know, resets you a little bit.
That's going to be hard for the driver who's upset about the traffic, though.
Right.
That ice bucket of water is just not going to work. Yeah. We're talking to Olga Hazad. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She's with us to talk about an experiment she tried recently to see if she could change her personality in 3 months, what she learned about the science of personality along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of those categories of personality, extrovert or introvert. Does one of those describe you? Do you like being that way? Have you tried to push yourself in one direction or another? How did it go? Have you made a conscious effort to change something about your personality? How did it go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with writer Olga Hazan from The Atlantic with us today to talk about a recent experiment where she tried to change her personality in a few different ways in just a few months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of the most common things, maybe, are you an introvert who tried to get out and talk to people at a bar or whatever? How did it go? Were you able to? Did you want to make that change? How did it work for you? Have you tried to dial down anger or anxiety? Meditation? Was that one of the tools you used? 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share or a question for our guest, 800-642-1234, as we talk about some of the science and psychology behind our personality. Olga, I just mentioned meditation. That's one of the things you tried. I think you were skeptical. You went to another person who'd been skeptical, Dan Harris, author of 10% Happier. He told us about his meditation journey on this show. Can you tell us how that worked, how you tried to use it to change your personality?
Yeah. So the big thing that made a difference for me was, so for me, meditation, I guess to back up, was very unsuccessful. So if I just turned off my phone and sat, you know, set a timer for 10 minutes and sat there, I would just ruminate about all my problems for 10 minutes, which is not especially helpful. So I was sort of like, how do people actually meditate? So I tweeted about this, and Dan kind of messaged me, and I downloaded his app, which really made a difference. So essentially what I found helps is guided meditations, which is sort of someone, you're mostly meditating and it's mostly just a quiet time for yourself, but there's a meditation teacher who's sort of walking you through and saying, okay, now picture yourself, you know, like in a river that's like really calm or whatever, or, you know, now imagine, you know, tell yourself that like everything's going to be okay. And like, I know it sounds really cheesy, but for me that really worked. And these guided meditations helped me kind of stay with the meditation as opposed to just veering off into anxiety land, which is what I was doing before.
Did that end up helping you when you weren't doing the guided meditation?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to say. So I did become less neurotic according to the tests that I took before and after. So I do think it, quote unquote, worked. But it, you know, it's hard to say whether that was because of the meditation, or I was doing all of this journaling. Like whenever I was anxious about something, I had to like, counteract it with, you know, two reasons why it might work out well. Or, you know, if I thought someone was mad at me, I had to, you know, come up with two reasons why they actually might just be having a bad day or something like that. So I was sort of constantly retraining my mind to break out of this loop of anxiety that has really been with me my entire life.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Terry is with us in Racine. Terry, hello.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I thought it was interesting when you talked about changing personalities. I was a real introvert in high school. I didn't feel like I was one of the crowd. You know, I was bullied a little bit, but I wasn't one of the real popular cute little girls. I had a deep voice. I was kind of a tomboy, and I turned into a real introvert. And then I got into, I was an engineer for a biomedical company, and I had to start talking to people in, you know, surgical suites and to the FDA. And I found that by practicing, getting in front of a mirror and practicing over and over again, I started getting a lot of confidence. And pretty soon, I started actually enjoying it and volunteering to go talk to people because it was kind of fun. You know, when you could get an audience to laugh with you and do things, and it really changed my personality around.
Terry, I got to ask though, did you find it exhausting to get up in front of a whole bunch of people, or are you just roll with it now?
I just kind of roll with it. You know, I think COVID kind of tempered that a little bit because I haven't been around people and I kind of have been avoiding people. Mm. But, you know, before that, we'd be on trips and I'd get in the elevator and I'd see somebody and I'd travel with a friend of mine. And he would say, you know, you would talk to a beat, you know, sitting on a table, because I would just start talking to people. So it kind of rolled over into my other life. Like I said, it's been tempered with COVID, but, you know, it's actually kind of fun once you start doing it, because people like to talk, and people like to talk about themselves, and you can find out a lot of really interesting things about people, and I like to hear their stories. So it's been a good thing.
Terry, thanks a lot for sharing that. It reminds me, Olga, another part of your introvert-extrovert story was part of your routine was you would try to just walk up and talk to a group of strangers at a bar. I've spent a fair amount of time at bars. That's something I still wouldn't feel comfortable doing.
Yeah, it was very weird. It was actually the activity that I enjoyed least. I have never voluntarily talked to strangers in a bar except for a story. And so not even for this story, but just like, hey, I'm here at this bar as a reporter. And what do you think about the latest law that says blah, blah, blah? You know, and I don't even really like doing that. And that's my job. So this made me really uncomfortable. I feel like maybe my discomfort was palpable. It also was a kind of, I think, maybe the wrong setting for this. Like, it was a little bit more of a dinner spot than like a dive bar where people are kind of shooting the shit and there's a big row of people, you know. It's also in DC where people are a little more closed off. Still, I tried to make conversation with the bartender and I wasn't able to, but the two people sitting next to me were. So I don't know. I might just need a little more practice with this one, but it did not go very well.
Talking to Olga Kazan from The Atlantic, looking at her 3-month experiment to change her personality, what she learned about the psychology and science of personality along the way. Olga, are you a different Olga now?
You know, I really think I am. Like, I think in particular, it's not so much that you wouldn't recognize me. You know, I'm totally, I just think that my view toward myself is a little bit different. Like, it really made me feel a lot more empowered. And it made me feel like if there is something about my life or about my habits or behaviors that I don't like, that they're within my power to control. It kind of made me feel like whenever I get down about, you know, I don't have that many friends or I don't really have any hobbies or I kind of, you know, my life is kind of boring. It kind of made me feel like I have the ability to really change that. And that was kind of one of the most gratifying things about doing this experiment.
Do other people in your life notice a difference?
I did ask my boyfriend if he noticed me behaving differently, and he said that I seem more grateful and more calm. He said that toward the end of the experiment. But I have to qualify that with the fact that he is a very positive person who has a very different personality than me. I do not know if that's colored by the fact that he sees everything in this kind of rosy way.
So, Olga, if somebody out there is listening thinking, yeah, there's this element of my personality that I would want to change, if I could change it myself, yeah, let's go for it. How would you advise them to get started on that process?
So you could just read my article and try some of the stuff that I did. but there's a really great researcher out there, Nate Hudson, who has done a lot of work on this. If you're able at all to read kind of scientific literature. You can kind of read through his studies and see kind of what he recommends. But otherwise, like if you're not into all that, you know, you could just imagine what would a person who is really conscientious act like, or what would a person who's really extroverted act like? And you can kind of just do that stuff. Like you don't really need permission from some professor to just behave differently. And behaving differently is really all that personality is. So I don't know. That's kind of my recommendation, is sort of fake it till you make it.
I wonder, going through this process of consciously trying to change some parts of your personality that you thought could use improvement, did you end up at a place where some of it was like, you know what, I'm going to accept it. That's who I am. And that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm always going to have these tendencies toward neuroticism and, introversion. I don't think that I'm ever going to completely eliminate those. You know, but I think that's okay. Like, I think as long as I understand how to turn the dial, you know, up and down on some of these things, you know, and to know that it's not permanent, or at least that I can flex myself in different situations. That to me is a really comforting feeling.
And just in our last half a minute, is it, you do this a lot in your work. Is it weird to share this deeply personal stuff with the world?
It was a little weird. Yeah, I guess so, maybe. But I don't know. It's hard to write an article like this without really revealing all your warts and all.
Fair enough. Olga, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
That's Olga Kazan, a staff writer at The Atlantic. She was with us today to talk about the science behind our personalities. And she put that science to the test with a 3-month experiment to see if she could change parts of her own personality. If you have a story like that to share, there's still time. You can do it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates in an effort to slow down inflation. What could that mean for you and for the wider economy? Join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions. And it's a massive dinosaur battle featuring the Tyrannosaurus Rex and the latest research about T-Rex and how it's changing our understanding of the big dinosaur. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the Biden administration is going to social media influencers to combat misinformation about Russia's war in Ukraine. We explore the role social media is playing in the spread of information for better or for worse. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a UW-Platteville professor of Russian history joins us from Poland to talk about the Ukrainian refugee crisis. First, Russia's attack on Ukraine is more than just a military operation. There's also an information war. The Russian government is pushing out propaganda and false information about their actions in Ukraine in an attempt to cover up or justify the attacks. The Biden administration tried to combat that misinformation last week when they held a private briefing for a few dozen social media influencers in the U.S. to give them more accurate info about the conflict to share with their followers. The Washington Post obtained a recording of that briefing, which started with an introduction from White House Director of Digital Strategy, Rob Flaherty.
Obviously, we value the work you all are doing informing your followers the ongoing events, and we recognize this is a critically important avenue in the way that the American public is finding out about the latest. So we wanted to make sure you had the latest information from us from an authoritative source. We're here to answer your questions and give you a quick overview.
We're learning more about what misinformation is out there, how it spreads, and the role social media plays. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble knowing what to believe, what to share coming out of Ukraine? Where do you go for credible information? Do you see misinformation popping up on your various social media feeds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Joshua Tucker is a professor of politics at New York University. He's director of the Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia and co-director of the Center for Social Media and Politics at NYU. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jen Schrady is an assistant professor of sociology at the Paris Institute of Political Studies. She's author of the book, The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. Jen, thanks for coming on with us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, both of you have been watching the spread of political related misinformation online and through social media. First, your overall thoughts. Let's start with you, Jen. What are you seeing? What kind of things are you watching for in the flow of mis and disinformation?
It's really spectacular, not only the amount of disinformation that's coming out over the war, but the media coverage of it as well. Not just us talking about it here, but the hyper focus, as many have called this, a so-called TikTok war to try to counteract Russian disinformation. But what's really interesting is how this type of propaganda or disinformation really is nothing new, right? If we think about how propaganda has been used in previous wars by multiple sides. And the introduction of the Biden private conference calling in influencers. And of course, there was a Saturday Night Live skit about that as well. But, you know, if we really think about, again, how propaganda has been used, and celebrities, right? Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis during World War II, even Disney characters, et cetera. And so we're seeing this as a way to counteract what's happening in Russia, which is pretty profound, the amount of disinformation that continues despite cutting off social media that many Russians rely on.
Josh, I think people have looked at social media as something new when it comes to, I think, the rate at which misinformation can spread. Do you see changes in the way that the media, that, say, other governments like the United States government, is trying to keep up with them, get out ahead of them, and try to counter them?
Sure. Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things about this current conflict is, as much as we all sort of jump immediately to disinformation, and there is a ton of disinformation out there that's emanating from the Russian state authorities around the war, we've also, however, in the course of this conflict, seen the power of social media to actually spread information as well. If we go back to the days right before the invasion, the Russian government was essentially pushing out three narratives about why this invasion was justified. One of those narratives was that the Ukrainians were ruled by Nazis and drug addicts, a particularly egregious statement for a country with a Jewish president, and that these people were completely unpopular, and that as soon as Russia marched into the ground, troops would lay down their weapons and would greet them as liberators. There was also a story that was being put out as well about there being a genocide in the eastern part of the country where Russian speakers were being killed. We saw a technique that's known as pre-bunking. There's been research that's been done on this at the micro level, looking at this in labs, where you expose people to potential disinformation before they encounter it in the wild. And that's kind of what the US government tried to do by get out in front of this and say, look, the Russians are going to claim X, they're going to say they're doing Y, and then they're going to go ahead and do Z. And one of the things that's been kind of, really interesting about this is the fact that those narratives that I talked to you about that were getting so much play in the run-up to the war, you don't really hear those anymore. Now, we can talk about sort of new disinformation narratives that have emerged since then, but this kind of pre-bunking strategy, I think, on the part of the Biden administration by releasing some of this intelligence information, I think was remarkably effective. And it was also augmented by the fact that we had all these images coming out of Ukraine so quickly. So Jen talked about a lot of things, I think, that were similar to conflicts that took place decades ago or even centuries ago. But one thing that's different now is just how fast information flows from the battlefield to the rest of the world. And that makes it harder to sustain some of these particular disinformation narratives, such as that the Ukrainian troops would just fold and lay down their arms.
Jen, I know there's a lot of focus on, I guess, top-down propaganda from Putin and his closest followers. I know in your book, you, I think, make the case that a lot of information obviously is coming from maybe everyday people or organized groups of people. How much do you focus here on the top-down approach from, say, Putin and his followers to everyday people, a bottom-up type movement of social information?
Absolutely. There's so much hyper focus on, as you said, the top down politicians or even the platforms, you know, pointing fingers at Putin or even Zuckerberg, right? Which are obviously really key. But what I found in my research is that really building on decades of other communication research, that really people on the ground, grassroots activists on every side are really a key part of any kind of information ecosystem. I did my research in the US where, you know, even before Trump, and certainly into his presidency, there was a tremendous amount of grassroots, kind of mainstream conservatives, far right, even very far right preppers who were really engaged and kept this kind of really ideological information going. And, you know, seeing reports coming out of Russia where you know, people are outside of Russia are trying to reach their relatives and family members. And there's a lot of talk of how people on the ground in Russia as well are sharing information, not only on these larger platforms, but also specifically on Telegram and other ways that people are sharing information that really kind of digs into local communities, right? Whether it's local religious groups or community groups. And I think that's what's really missing. Sometimes we have this idea that disinformation is kind of injecting us or injecting people with information and that we're all just robots following whatever we hear. But the reality is that audiences are active and engaged, and we really need to understand how people on the ground are engaging with this information rather than thinking it'll simply stop by cutting off some of these major platforms.
We're talking about misinformation, Russia and Ukraine, and Jen Schrady is with us from the Paris Institute of Political Studies, Josh Tucker from New York University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you trust social media influencers to be credible sources? Do you agree with the Biden administration's idea to reach out to some of those influencers? What are you seeing when it comes to the spread of information, misinformation online, in social media, your own social media feeds coming from Russia and the invasion of Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your observations or questions. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on Russian misinformation in Ukraine and on social media. Our guests today are New York University politics professor Josh Tucker and Paris Institute of Political Studies professor Jen Schrady. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, what you are seeing coming through your social media feed, anything striking you as inauthentic, suspicious. 800-642-1234 is the number if you'd like to join. That's 800-642-1234. Josh, this strategy from the White House of briefing TikTok influencers in particular, what do you think of that idea?
So I think it's part and parcel of thinking about disinformation in this conflict in one of three ways, right? We need to think about disinformation campaigns that are targeting the Russian population. We want to think about disinformation campaigns that are targeting the Ukrainian population, which we're going to see more and more of as the war drags on. And we think about disinformation campaigns that are targeting people in the rest of the world. So obviously, when the Biden campaign is trying to talk to TikTok influencers, this is, you know, possibly trying to reach into the Russian consciousness here, but this is mainly something that's focused on this larger question of how the sort of broader world perceives the support for the perceives the war and thinks about what the West's response should be here. So I think it's clever on the part of the Biden administration if not inviting a little bit of mockery here, as Jen noted with the SNL skit that appeared on this. But the reality is that now people get news in a variety of different ways. And we know that whereas some people still tend to get, lots of people get news from TV, lots of people get news from Facebook. There is also a growing constituency for these kind of short form videos as a source of news. And the growth in the use of TikTok has been just exponential, right? I was looking at my notes, my lecture notes this fall, and last year I had written, I can't believe there are 100 million people using TikTok already. And then this year when I had to update it, I had to update that to 1 billion people. Wow. So as Jen noted, right, if you want to reach public opinion, and if you think in the course that over the longer term, sustaining public support for the costly steps that are being taken by countries in the West right now in terms of the economic cost they're going to bear from some of these sanctions, which is the major tool that's being wielded here, building up public support for the need to take these sanctions is kind of important. And if you want to reach the public, there are a variety of different tools one can use to try to reach the public. And I think assuming that if you go only on TV, you're going to reach everybody is a mistake in the current day and era. So I give them credit for doing it, even though it's probably, even though it opens them up to a little bit of mockery.
Jen, do you have thoughts for the poor social media user who's bombarded with information and dis and misinformation whenever they go to their feed potentially? How are we supposed to sort things out when we're just sitting down to see what's up with our friends' kittens?
Yes, as one of my students noted that, you know, they're getting exactly the kitten TikToks and then a report about the war, very meaningful, and then a makeup tutorial right after that, right? So it's tricky. The other interesting variety of comments that I've found from a number of my students, it'd be interesting to study this, is there, and these are students who are really engaged in politics, they do not want to share any information about what's happening in Ukraine because they're so worried about disinformation that they're hesitating. And if we think about really one of the goals of disinformation and Russia, that all along has been one of the outcomes and, you know, presumably the goals is to really not only put out disinformation, but really shake things up enough that people are really questioning what's happening. And so, as you mentioned, it is really challenging to try to weed through everything. More and more people are just getting their news from a variety of feeds, and knowing what to trust and what not to trust is really important. So it was very heartening to hear a lot of my students talk about how much they're now going back to traditional news outlets because of this problem with disinformation. They are certainly struck by the emotional grab of a lot of the TikTok and other videos that are coming out. But to really understand the broader context, they're going to the news media. And that's really one of the dangers of just thinking about these short form videos as a way to kind of position the war, is that we're left without a broader sense of what's happening. And we also risk the war being more presented to the broader world as a form of entertainment rather than important political news to really react to.
Josh, we have just a minute left. What are you watching for next in this global misinformation battle?
Can I just make a quick, follow-up sure. to the point that Jen made a second ago? Because you asked at the beginning of the hour, you know, what can readers do? And one of the most interesting new projects that we have going on in our research lab has been looking at the effect of what happens when people search for information online, when they're trying to figure out whether a news story is true or not. And what we found is that for false news stories, stories that are fake, when people search for news online, they're actually more likely to believe those false news stories. If they sort of follow up by like putting the headline of that false news story into Google and searching for it. And it's precisely because some of these more obscure false stories, we think, are not covered by mainstream news as much. And so what they find is other false news in there. So I just want to really emphasize to your listeners the point Jen made, that if you are going to try to check the veracity of news, simply Googling a headline or Googling a question might bring you back other false news information. So going back to sort of tried and true news sources that you know you can trust ahead of time, well-known mainstream news outlets, is a much safer strategy than simply Googling it. So I would just sort of add that as a kind of answer to your question at the beginning of the hour, but just as sure. a follow-up to the point Jen made.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests, Joshua Tucker, professor of politics at New York University, Jen Schrady, assistant professor of sociology at the Paris Institute of Political Studies, with us for a look at Russian information during the invasion of Ukraine. This week, WPR marks 2 years of the pandemic in Wisconsin with stories about how COVID-19 has changed us in lasting ways. Before March of 2020, face masks were a rare sight outside of medical settings. Then they became charged political symbols. Now, as the CDC relaxes its guidance on when to wear them, Bridget Bowden reports that for many people, face masks are here to stay.
Before November 2020, Margaret Wilkins of Oconomowoc was a kindergarten teacher. But then she got COVID-19. Her symptoms, weakness, dizziness, fatigue, heart issues, were really scary.
I ended up never going back to school. I tried to go back to teach in January. I couldn't make it. I was so exhausted. I barely made it like a couple hours.
Wilkins decided to retire early. Now she's fully vaccinated and boosted, but she'll never forget how difficult her bout with COVID was. She says she's scared about getting it again, so she always wears a mask indoors. And she says she'll continue to wear a mask in some form or fashion for a long time, maybe forever.
Basically, every place I go, I wear a mask. And like I said, you know, I'm retired, so I don't have to really worry about right now going to work or going to a place for my job. And so if I did, I probably would wear a mask. I most likely would wear a mask.
Masking will also continue to be an important safety measure for Heidi Stino of Milwaukee. Stino and her husband run a small art business where they travel to various art fairs and events. She says they'll continue to wear masks because they just can't afford to get sick.
One of us getting sick or even having to quarantine meant we could not be out selling artwork and keeping our paying our mortgage, buying groceries.
Masks have been important for Stino's family in more ways than one. Back in 2020, they began making fabric masks as a way to keep their business afloat while many of the art fairs were canceled.
We kind of stopped counting after like 5,000.
Now they mostly wear N95 respirators. And even though she had never worn a mask before the pandemic, she thinks she'll continue to mask in public for a long time to come.
Especially like in the November, December months when like, you know, colds and flu and starts to show its face again.
Wilkins and Stino are not alone. Ajay Sethi, a population health professor at UW-Madison, says he expects to see plenty of people continuing to wear masks long into the future. In addition to COVID-19, Sethi says masks can help protect against other respiratory pathogens like rhinovirus, enterovirus, and RSV.
And if you're around somebody who's coughing or sneezing, it may not be, you know, SARS-CoV-2. It may be something else. So wearing a mask protects against all those things that spread by large droplets.
And Sethi expects to see people wearing masks in certain situations where people are in close contact with each other, like airplanes.
I think we've always understood that some situations did make us sick before, and we gutted it out, never thinking to wear a mask before COVID. Now we will. We've got this extra tool. Masks are available. People know how to source them. And it's a good idea to use them.
Patricia Tellez-Giron, a professor of family medicine at UW-Madison, remembers occasionally seeing people wearing masks before 2020 and thinking it was unusual.
I remember traveling a few years back and seeing people wearing masks at the airport and making almost even fun of them and saying, ooh, what is that? Or even fearing them like, oh, are they really sick?
Now she's changed her perspective.
No, they were smart. You know, in the countries, they already have learned what we just learned.
2 years into the COVID-19 pandemic, it's still hard to know what the future looks like. But for some, that future will include wearing masks. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, a Russian history professor joins the program from Krakow, Poland, to talk about what he's seeing as millions of Ukrainian refugees escape into that country, including his parents. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.